Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. 2013 will go down as the year of the split opinion when it comes to the movies. The Wolf of Wall Street, some people loved it, some very much disliked it. Inside Llewyn Davis, the Coen brothers' best film, some said, were a film that yours truly almost walked out of. Gravity, very mixed reviews. You get the idea. Today, our independent foreign and documentary film critics are here to talk about the Critics' Choice Movie Awards, and we'll find out which film they thought was the year's best. We'll also get some reviews of some new films, including August Osage County, that a lot of people are looking forward to. But be forewarned, Bob Butler wasn't thrilled with it. Our critics today, film professor Cynthia Haynes. Cynthia, happy new year to you.
Thank you very much, Steve.
KCUR Steve Walker is back. Stephen, how are you?
I am, thanks. I'm good.
And Rapid Robert Butler, the longtime film critic for The Star, who now works at the Kansas City Public Library. You can see and read his reviews at butlercinemascene.com. Bob, how are you?
I'm thrilled.
Well, Bob, this was the year of the split opinion, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, what's going on out
there?
Well,
you know, this is interesting. If you look at almost every major film that has come out, people are just violently divided on them. I have a theory about this.
That's what I wanted to hear.
I'm not paid to have a theory, but here it goes anyway. I'm calling this the winter of our discontent because our major filmmakers have decided to make films about essentially disagreeable characters, and then they kind of defy themselves to make them so interesting that we get on board. Hmm. Think about it. What's a film you've seen with a happy, kind of upbeat? Okay, Philomena.
Frozen.
Yeah. All right. Now, let's go to The Wolf of Wall Street about, you know, rampant capitalism and greed.
12 Years a Slave.
12 Years a Slave. Let's go to, American Hustle about con artists. Let's go to, well, for that matter, August Osage County about serious family dysfunction.
Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah. So basically, the anti-hero is in full force here, and frankly, there aren't very many warm fuzzies to grab onto.
It's interesting. Yeah.
If Hollywood is searching and worried about money, why the anti-hero then? Why making films that way? What's that about?
Well, I think it's a good omen because you've got filmmakers who are making edgy films. They're not trying to appeal to the common denominator.
Edgy or dull, Cynthia, depending
well,
on which
yes,
one we're talking
yes,
about.
Well, yes, that's very true. But, I mean, I wouldn't describe a lot of these movies as great works of art, but art is controversial.
And I think is a give and take. You try it, you screw up sometimes, and you keep forging ahead.
That's right.
Well, to cite an example with one actor, we'll talk about August in more depth, but Julia Roberts, I don't like. I've never liked her in
anything.
She said
nice things about you.
Well, that's fine. not to my face. She holds her own in this film, and she does a good job. And here's why. Because she doesn't have to be liked. Mm. I think that's been the Achilles heel of her whole career, is that everyone's got to like her, and every trailer has her chortling like a horse.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about that.
She's good in this film. She really is. And I was very disappointed to hear that she'd been cast in this, which is really the starring role.
But it is always kind of an amazing thing to me that two people can walk into a movie theater and one person can watch a film like Inside Llewyn Davis and think, this is just terrific stuff. And the person, you know, 3 feet away is walking out thinking, that was just horrible. What is that?
This is where I stand.
We're all smart people. We're all linking arms here. What is it? Yeah. You know?
I mean, when I sat and watched the film after having seen full-page ads in the New York Times touting it as the best movie of the year, quoting well-known critics as saying it's the best thing the Coen brothers has ever done, and I sat there and I kept looking at my watch, for one thing, and then I thought, is this the same movie I've been reading about? I just really felt like I didn't get it. If it's that great, I mean.
Well, and I have that feeling often when I see, you know, smart movie critics supposedly raving about something, and I walk out thinking just the opposite. I'm thinking, you know, instead of thinking I'm okay with my own opinion, I walk out thinking, what did I miss? Because clearly I missed something there, you know?
Well, I'm just thinking about this new thing you see in reviews all the time. It's an instant classic.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really exist. But a lot of people are using that. When we went to the screening of Gravity way back when, the owner at Alamo said, you're going to see the best movie you've ever seen. And, you know, people talk this way. They can't be honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Let's pull it back. It's probably not the greatest movie ever made.
I mean, do you recall a time when we've been so split? I mean, so split just up and down the line as we were this last 12 months?
No, I don't think so. I want to make another point, though, too. If you listen to actors talk about their films, more often than not, they'll say, I love playing the villain. I love playing the messed up character. Look at Cate Blanchett in Blue Jasmine. I mean, she certainly wasn't a lovable character, but boy, did Cate Blanchett.
But boy, was she interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Unlike Llewyn Davis, which, we'll get into later. But
you do find yourself going to some of these films. I'm thinking of American Hustle, which I thought was an okay movie, not great. But you go, because people were telling me, go watch the women actresses there, you know, Amy Adams and Jennifer Lawrence.
Right.
And they were right. Those two women were captivating in that film.
Yeah,
and just
they really were
terrific. And it made that experience fun for me. But the film as a whole sort of left me, well, whatever.
Well, you know? I embody that split opinion. When I saw the screener, I had worked all day. I was tired. I didn't even get to go home and rest or anything. And I was like, oh, this movie will never end. And then the critics got a screener in the mail. I watched it again a couple weeks later on my own time, and I really liked it.
I think this is an interesting phenomenon.
That's interesting.
As critics, we're supposed to see it once and give our opinion. But the truth is, movies, even some of the best ones, they have to dig in a little bit. You kind of have to expose yourself more than once to really appreciate what's going on there. I've seen Llewyn Davis now a couple times, and the things I like about it, I like even more, and the things that bother me a lot less. I suspect that's going to be the case with American Hustle. I'm not so sure about Wolf of Wall Street.
I mean, that's interesting, Bob, in the sense that when you hear music, I've often wondered how critics can respond to the first listening of a new album that some artist has put out, when so many times with music, we've all had this experience, it's the sixth time or the tenth time you listen to a track that something switches in your brain.
Absolutely.
And certain chemicals flow, and suddenly the album is the greatest thing you've ever heard in your life. But from time number one,
It's nuts.
Yeah.
Stop me while I kiss this guy. Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Jimi Hendrix, remember?
Kiss this guy. Do you remember?
Yeah, kiss this guy.
Yeah.
This is the problem that critics are always going to have to deal with. The theater, it's always opening night. They don't want you to write the review a week later. They want it in as soon as possible. One of the happy things about being a critic is that sometimes you're allowed to take the long view. In the world of blogs, there's no one that says you can't go back a week, a month, or a year later. Look at what you liked and what you didn't like.
Great
and
point.
See, were you right? Were you wrong?
Yeah.
Did it hold up? Did it fade? In just the 2 months since I saw Gravity, I've almost forgotten what Gravity was about as an experience. I remember watching it on the screen and going, hot dang, look at this. But the emotional effect of it has totally faded away.
Yeah.
Nebraska, it's still with me.
Yeah, that movie's still with me, too. Yeah.
There's another thing going on here, too. What do you figure? Over 400 to 600 movies a year are made and distributed. And the New York Times has a rule that if it shows in New York for 1 week, you know, it'll get a mention in the newspaper. All of these films, the dozen or so films that are being named again and again and again by different critics groups and different organizations, are all movies that were sent to us via screeners.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is curious that there are virtually no movies on these lists for which we did not get a screener. And so we're narrowing down that choice, all these options of movies we could see, because they're being literally marketed and championed by certain distributors and certain studios. And if your film isn't on their list, you don't get consideration.
Well, if our listeners want to chime in here on this thesis that we're trotting out this morning, that 2013 was the year of the split opinion when it came to so many of our films, give us a shout, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us @KCUR Up to Date. And Bob, this notion, and I hate to throw this idea out at you as someone who has written so many reviews for so many years, but should critics see a film more than once before rendering an absolute judgment one way or the other?
In the best of all possible worlds, yes. Do we live in the best of all possible worlds, Steve?
Not even close, right?
See, there you
go. Don't we all know? Yeah.
In the world of daily journalism, it's just impossible.
Mm-hmm. How often does your opinion tend to switch when you go from the first viewing to the second?
This is interesting. By and large, one in maybe 50 movies do I have a significant shift.
Well, that's interesting. So maybe it wouldn't be worth the time after all.
Well, yeah, on the other hand, like I say, there are two or three movies I've got to see again because I think there may be more there than I got first time around. Yeah. I might have just had critic during Christmas burnout.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we saw a lot.
Do you switch opinions frequently or not?
I do, but, Blockbusters are closing in Kansas City, and I went to a closeout final clearance sale the other day and bought about 15 movies. And you look at what I bought. Whether I'll watch it again in the next 3 years, I don't know, but I like having it.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Gomorrah, the Italian film, An Education with Carey Mulligan. Four months, 3 weeks, 2 days,
this Romanian film.
I mean, I loved them all at the time, and they were there for $1.99. I said, I'm taking this home,
yeah,
just in case.
Right.
You know,
right,
I can review it later.
Yeah. Cynthia, would you qualify as a waffler yourself? You see it once and you switch your opinion the second time?
It has happened on occasion. It really has. And you know, again, our first impression is critical, no pun intended, because we are literally asked as we leave the movie theater our impression of the movie we just watched. And like a good book or again, another work, great work of art, it does take time for you to analyze it and let it soak in and for you to really form an intelligent, solid opinion.
Somebody once asked me what it was like, you know, if I was ever disappointed in the reviews I'd written. And what I said, you strive to write the best review in the time you've got, and sometimes that is very little time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a lot of room for rumination. You do the best you can under the circumstances, and then let the long term, you know, the long view kick in later on.
Have you been wrong sometimes when you just still, you wince thinking back on it? You called a movie just, it was just awful, and now it won universal acclaim as the year progressed?
I can't pick one out of my head, but I'm sure that has happened.
Yeah.
Well, geez, I didn't think that much of Caddyshack, and now I understand it's a classic.
An instant classic.
It was an instant classic.
Well, the same thing happened with Young Frankenstein. I saw it in a movie theater by myself, Mel Brooks' movie, and I thought, this is the stupidest movie. And then I wound up going to see it in a theater that was packed with people. I thought it was the funniest movie I'd seen all year. So, I mean, also the circumstances under which you watch a movie really affect how you react
and
to it.
Yeah, you mentioned, Cynthia, we get all these screeners, but we saw most things on big screens. I don't want people to get the impression that we're just, you know, holed up in our houses watching them on a TV screen.
Hang on. I want to grab a call here from Mike from Shawnee, who I think wants to walk down the road that you're walking down right now. Mike, good morning.
Hey, you've kind of answered my question. With the advent of DVDs and now Blu-rays, I've always been curious about how you guys watch the films now. Do you watch them on small screens or computers or whatever? I mean, movies, I'm sure you'll agree, are made to be watched on a big screen. And I've been to Sundance half a dozen times. I've been to the Cannes Film Festival. And to think that somebody would, and you've already answered my question, you watch most of them in the theaters on a big screen, and I applaud you for that. Just fight off the urge to watch a movie. I mean, a great example would be Gravity. That needs to be seen on a big screen.
Yeah, I agree.
4K projector. Anyway.
Mike, hang on. Cynthia and Bob, do you both watch most of your movies on the big screen?
I try to.
Long ago I came up with a sort of a formulation, a Butler's thesis, let's call it. A good movie is less good watched on a small screen. A bad movie is more tolerable watched on a small screen.
I read an interesting article in Variety. It was a roundtable of cinematographers. They are changing the way they are shooting movies these days to accommodate iPads and...
Oh, that's depressing.
It is depressing, but they're realizing that more and more people are watching on
you
their computers.
You try watching Lawrence of Arabia on your iPhone. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, in answer to his question, and we've talked about this on the show, that more and more indie films, really low-budget indies, docs, we get a link in our email, and we stream it on your whatever screen you're using for your computer. I want a bigger screen. There's a huge Mac screen in this studio. I shouldn't say that. Someone will come and take it. But I want to upgrade my home viewing system in order to accommodate all the films we're getting that way.
But we're leaving one thing out. Drama began as a religious celebration in Greece. It's about an audience coming together to worship. Think about that. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll tell you, modern audiences can just chap my rear end. They're so rude and, you know, at the same time, the audience, the whole experience of being part of a group of like-minded people who got off their duffs and came to the theater, that prepares you for what you're going to experience.
Right.
Hey, and Mike, are you still there?
Yes, yeah. I'm listening and agreeing. I mean,
I'm just wondering,
if you go to a theater in New York, those audiences are even ruder than they are in Kansas City. I mean, people take phone calls, make phone calls. You hear some guy saying, you know, what are you doing? I'm not doing anything. Well, I'm in the dark with 300 people or 3,000 or whatever, and he's having a phone call.
Well, Mike, you sound like you know your movies. Do you agree, was 2013 the year of the split opinion when it came to our films last year, by and large?
You know, I really do. It's been kind of amazing because you see these films, and then one reviewer thinks it's just the greatest thing since sliced bread, and the other one can't stand it.
Yeah.
And I wonder, what is changing that we are in this situation? I mean, I don't know, it's an interesting business, and I think part of it is that studios are, as one of your guests said just a minute ago, that they are filming for the small screen. I mean, the really small screen, which is pretty discouraging if that's true.
Bob, hop in here.
Well, you know, I have another thought here. Hollywood still knows how to hit the mass audience with a mass movie. The movies we're all talking about, the films we're talking about, Wolf of Wall Street even, maybe Scorsese, but Scorsese is not a box office smash, generally speaking. He's still considered an art film director, even though he has a commercial distribution and, you know, the whole rigmarole. I'm wondering, it seems to me that the general mass audience hasn't changed, but the art film audience may have.
That's
and I'm wondering what the element is that's making that happen.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I won't keep you any longer. You were kind of call. I sure appreciate it.
Okay, enjoy it, Steve. Thanks.
You bet. Well, as Bob, you were pointing out a few minutes ago, even before the show began, we've gone through this string of an interesting time in the films. Lots of interesting titles coming out on the market, which is typical for December, getting ready for award season coming up here, which we'll turn to in a minute. But you've also said that, hey, but now that we're in January, here come the doldrums.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes to the films.
Well, you know, it's all about Oscar season, which is why, God bless us, critics have to see all the year's best movies in a three-week period. It's like, you know, it's like walking around the oval track for 9 months, and then suddenly you're expected to run a marathon.
Yeah, yeah.
They shoot off all their guns. This Friday is the last wave of Oscar-contending movies to open in Kansas City.
Right.
And for the next 2 months, it's going to be the stuff that was left at the bottom of the barrel.
Hmm. Which is the way it always
happens, always is. Right? This is nothing new. Yeah,
there's some great stuff coming, and we'll talk about that at the very end of the show.
There's a reason to live out
well,
there.
Yeah, the movie like The Past from the director of A Separation is brilliant.
Yeah, but we're talking foreign films which live in their own world.
Okay. Well, sure.
Yeah, there's a movie Monuments Men with George Clooney.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it was supposed to open in December. A lot of distributors and filmmakers get frustrated because there are no slots for them to put their movies in at the end of the year. And also, Scorsese's film almost didn't get released because he was still fiddling in the editing room at the very last minute. So the pressure's on a lot of filmmakers, and I think some of them have to let go of their projects before they're finished.
Well, speaking of awards, let's turn to the Critics' Choice Movie Awards coming up this coming Thursday, because Cynthia, once again, you're going to rub it in all of our faces. You're going to be there. You'll be there. I won't be there. I want to be there, too. What's the Critics' Choice Movie Awards?
Well, the Broadcast Film Critics Association is the largest film critics organization in the U.S. and Canada. I think there are about 280 television, radio, and online film critics who belong to this group. And what sets them apart is the fact that they have to see everything. I mean, most of these are working professionals in the film criticism business, and they see everything, so they have a good perspective. And also, it's an indicator for the Oscars, which is the one award show, and it's the Golden Globes is a whole other story, but this is the Oscars is the only one that really matters. I mean, when an actor's obituary is written, it said, you know, winner of the People's Choice Awards. It's, you know, they won an Oscar. And I think this also, the list that comes out from the critics group is the list of DVDs that a lot of these members of the Academy watch, because they get 100 DVDs to look at. And if they see 12 movies or nominated for Best Picture, well, why don't we just watch those 12? And then it tends to build on itself, and these films tend to be the ones nominated for Oscars. So I hope our listeners will tune in Thursday, the 16th.
And Critics' Choice, they have a list of films nominated for Best Picture, right?
And they can go to a website, the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. It'll be on the CW Network at 8 o'clock on Thursday. That's Eastern time. So what does that make it?
Seven,
our time. And there'll be a pre-show and everything. And it really is a fun opportunity for a critic like myself who doesn't get to go to on these junkets where a lot of film critics get a chance to interact with the filmmakers and with the actors and actresses.
And you get to rub shoulders with these folks in a big way at this event, right?
Yeah.
You bring back your pictures every year.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. So, I mean, I hate to do lists, but I just want to mention as far as actors go, Christian Bale will be there.
Well, give us a list of the best picture nominees first. That's what people might be interested in the most. Yeah.
American Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, Gravity, Her, Inside Llewyn Davis, Nebraska, Saving Mr. Banks, 12 Years a Slave, and The Wolf of Wall Street.
Well, of that list, Steve, what would you vote for?
12 Years a Slave.
Because it was the best picture, but do you think it really was?
Yeah, to me it was. Yeah.
Yeah, I still haven't seen it.
It's the most artful, the most heartfelt.
I would give it a tie between 12 Years a Slave and Her.
No kidding. Cynthia?
I watched 12 Years a Slave again. It held up. It was even more profound in my mind after I saw it a second time.
So you think it feels like that's got Oscar written all over it.
Yeah, I think so.
There's political reasons there, it seems to me, and you all are saying it's a great film.
Yeah, but the director is a black man from Britain, and I think there's still a lot of racism and homophobia in Hollywood, and you never know how things will shake out.
Yeah, interesting.
And it is a popularity contest. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
You know, if you play the game and you participate in marketing your movie, your chances are much better of getting an award.
You know, without running through the entire list now of best actors, Cynthia, who would get your nod just based on this list that's in front of us here?
Chiwetel Ejiofor, The 12 Years a Slave. But also, this might be, I don't know, surprise to some people, but Robert Redford is the only actor in this film, All Is Lost, I thought did a pretty good job.
There's talk that he will be probably nominated for an Oscar, and who knows?
He got a standing ovation at some award show, and again, like I said, a popularity contest.
It feels like that where we could be going.
The Don Ameche Award will go to Redford.
Steve Walker, who's your best actor in this group?
Chiwetel Ejiofor, I think. And my favorite actress is Kate Blanchett in Blue Jasmine. I haven't seen a performance like that in a long time.
I agree with you.
I'd have to agree with Steve on those choices. I think those are pretty safe.
Aren't we boring? I mean, we really...
Yeah, it's so much for your theory at the opening of the show, Kraske.
So Bruce Dern, who's up for Nebraska, will probably be nominated.
I hope so.
But there seems to be a sense he's always been denied this, and now maybe this is his year. But you don't think he's going to win it.
No, but held up against these other actors.
You never know. I mean, you know, he's a sentimental choice, too. Redford has one.
Yeah. Does he have one?
For directing Ordinary People,
For directing.
But not for acting. Right.
Yeah, okay. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll dive into our films and get some reviews out the door here. August, Osage County, Her, and The Great Beauty, and a bunch of others. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date.
This is 89.3 FM, KCUR, online at kcur.org. Coming up this afternoon on Science Friday, this frigid cold snap has a silver lining, especially if you're a tree. Find out why. Plus, we take a look at why spoiled food tastes so good. It's a fermentation fest on Science Friday, today between 2 and 4 on KCUR. Up to Date is made possible in part by the Kansas City Garden Symposium, February 22nd at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, with lectures and gardening advice by four garden book authors. Early registration ends January 18th. Details are online at gardensymposium.org. And the Kansas City Symphony, with Michael Stern conducting Beethoven's Seventh Symphony and Violin Concerto, featuring concertmaster Noah Geller, today through Sunday at the Kauffman Center. Details are online at kcsymposium.org. The time is 11:30. It's 37 degrees in Midtown Kansas City. Rain today, mainly before 2. Cloudy skies, a high of 40 degrees. Then tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 28. You're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 FM, KCUR, Kansas City.
And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversations about the Maryville rape case or our look at life in the Flint Hills with Cynthia Hodel, you can find those in the weekend to-do list. Just go to kcur.org. Monday on the program, we talk with a former director of the NAACP about civil rights in 2014, plus a look at the rise of the metropolis in the 21st century. That's Monday on the program. This hour, we're visiting with our independent art and foreign film critics, Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. And let's turn to some new films that are now out. And Steve Walker, you have a review up of August Osage County at kcur.org. And you want to talk about it here. This is an adaptation of a Pulitzer Prize-winning play about the reunion of a dysfunctional Northeast Oklahoma family.
Yeah. Emphasis on dysfunctional.
Yeah.
I loved this piece. I saw it twice on Broadway with two different actresses playing this mother. It's about a family. She's got three daughters. She's dying of mouth cancer. She's addicted to pills. And she being Meryl Streep, who, you know, we've lauded a lot on this show. The play is much better than the film. I like the film a lot. It's on my three to see for a couple reasons. The play was 3 hours long, epic. It felt epic in every way. And at 3 hours, seeing it twice with my attention span, I was in love with the play.
Wow.
The film is, I don't know if it's the director. He just does nothing interesting with filming it. It's three daughters coming home because their father has died in the first 10 minutes, so I'm not spoiling anything, and dealing with their mom and her meanness and all the remnants of their childhoods, which weren't pleasant, but as Meryl Streep and Margot Martindale, who plays her sister, talk about, their childhood was even less pleasant and perhaps brutal.
Can you say something interesting here? You wonder where the source of your discontent comes from? I think it's because Tracy Letts, who adapted his own play into a screenplay, was still thinking theater and not movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was directed by a guy, John Wells, whose background is in television.
Huh.
So that might explain
it. Makes me wonder, what would Spike Jonze or what would Scorsese or David O. Russell done with this?
Well, now,
material.
We'd love to see that sometime, by the way.
There are some bleakly funny encounters in this.
Oh, it's hilarious.
But I don't want to make you think it's a comedy, because if you go thinking it's a comedy, you're going to say, well, I've just been cheated. This is really downbeat.
The previews of this film make you think it's a comedy.
And there are times,
several times.
The dinner scene took up all of Act Two in the play. It's the dinner after the funeral. And there are some lines in that are hysterically funny. And then what people are having problem with is the shift in tone. And then, you know, Meryl will say something so scathingly funny and biting, and then in the next sentence, talk about saving her sister from being beaten with a hammer when they were children. The shifts in tone have bothered a lot of people who've seen it.
You know what? Here's what happens. You take 3 hours of a leisurely paced play and cram it into 2 hours of a movie.
Right.
Some of those pauses are important.
I still recommend it. I think Meryl's performance is incredible. I think Julia Roberts is great. Chris Cooper is great.
I mean,
he plays her brother-in-law.
It's an overused term, but this is so true in this case.
Yes, so true.
Cynthia, hop in here.
I would see the movie again just for Meryl Streep. I mean, she is so over the top, but extraordinary. And I sort of feel the same way about Cate Blanchett's performance in Blue Jasmine. That film was very uneven for me, but her performance was great. Meryl Streep, I just think, is fantastic.
Bob, you're a big Meryl fan. You're not one of these people who find her affected and all of that.
No, she had the scenery chewing role.
Oh, yeah.
And she handled it beautifully. I actually found myself gravitating toward Julia Roberts is the daughter who hates her mom and fears that she's becoming her mom.
Right.
That's a very human situation.
Very real. Very
another
real.
Performance in there, Margot Martindale. There's
terrific.
Just something about her.
She's a great actress.
And whatever she does that really makes the film special.
There's a scene in the last act that people gasped at when I saw it in a theater filled with people for a reason. Just be prepared. I mean, let me tell you, I told my mom, before you and my stepdad watch this, I want you to hear something that Meryl said about taking this role. She wasn't going to do it because this woman is a monster. She said, I just can't go there. My mother was wonderful and supportive, and I just can't even imagine going there. And a friend of hers said to her, please go there for all of those people whose mothers weren't like yours.
Mm.
That's so profound. And mm-hmm. and that took her there.
What's the clip we got here, Stephen?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
It's Ivy, the third daughter, and Meryl having an exchange.
Okay.
What'd you do to your hair?
I had it straightened.
Why would anybody do that?
Just wanted a change.
You're a pretty girl. Why don't you wear makeup?
Do I need makeup?
Every woman needs makeup. Don't let anybody tell you different. The only woman pretty enough to go without makeup was Elizabeth Taylor. And she wore a ton. Shoulders are all slumped and your hair's all straight. You don't wear makeup. You look like a lesbian.
Mom.
You could get a decent man if you would just spruce up a bit. That's all I'm saying. My tongue is on fire.
You supposed to be smoking?
Is anybody supposed to smoke?
That's but, Meryl Streep in August, Osage County.
It just her inflection, her rhythm just takes the dialogue someplace.
I mean, we had this conversation occasionally, and on the list of the all-time great actresses, she's still top three, top, you know.
Yeah, she's got to be up there.
Yeah. And just to review, August, Osage County, Steve, you recommend it. It's on your three to see.
I do. Yes, I do.
Cynthia?
It's on my three to see.
Robert?
I'm going to say no.
No, I knew it wouldn't
say
be.
No. Yeah. Kind of a split opinion on August, Osage County. Okay, Cynthia Haynes, let's move on to a film. It's titled Her.
Yes, it's about a man in the near future, we're not quite sure when, who develops a romantic relationship with the female voice of his computer operating system. I am a major league fan of Spike Jones. He's done some of the more original films I've ever seen, Being John Malkovich, Adaptation.
Oh, yeah.
He is just brilliant, imaginative, great sense of humor, and this is basically a comedy. Joaquin Phoenix plays Theodore Twombly, who's a pretty isolated, lonely guy looking for love, I guess you could say, but whose job is to write intimate letters for people. The art of writing letters has been lost. So he writes these poetic pieces. And then he winds up with the OS-1, the first artificially intelligent operating system.
Hmm.
And it's voiced, much like Suri, by a woman, and that woman happens to be Scarlett Johansson, who has a very, very interesting voice and pulls this off, and they wind up having a relationship. This is a computer, and this is a guy who has a hard time connecting and relating to human beings. And I think there are some very profound, sad, some very hilarious moments in this that really is a commentary on our society of communicating through electronic devices.
So you liked it.
I did.
It also brings up an interesting question. How close does artificial intelligence come to actually being human? There's a wonderful moment in this where the voice, Samantha, she's called, admits that while she's talking to Theodore, she's also having conversations with 6,000 other people and operating systems.
Mm.
Is that cheating?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about it. A human being has only so much capacity for thought. We got to sleep. We got to eat. We got to chill out.
And so much capacity for relationships, too.
And what about a brain that has been programmed to learn and finds that her human is inadequate to that task?
Yeah.
Not enough stimulation. That's a parody of a male-female relationship or a female-male relationship.
And it is,
that happens to all of us at some point. Somebody outgrows somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
What grade did you give this film?
Oh, this to me is, like I say, the best film of the year, along with 12 Years a Slave. I think it's a fantastically good movie.
Steven?
Brace yourself.
Here comes that split opinion once again.
Yeah. I understand Spike Jones was trying to make a comment on how people don't communicate with each other except through devices and screens. But the story itself, I mean, it looked beautiful. This weird mix of – it's like sometime in the future when men wear their pants up to their sternum practically and the clothes are weird and it's L.A. mixed with Shanghai. And
wow.
That was interesting. But the story itself to me was so ludicrous. I mean, they have sex
see,
in
I don't,
the film, and it's
a
voice.
Sex?
Oh, well, sure.
Yeah, I didn't find it ludicrous. But I found it so close to being what we've got now that it was
right.
a little disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't buy it.
It was Scarlett Johansson's voice.
Well, I know.
Steve.
originally, the voice of the computer was Samantha Morton. And Spike Jonze finished the film, played it, and said, wrong voice.
No kidding.
And hired Scarlett Johansson to revoice the computer voice throughout the film.
This is one I will give another look to, and I will at some point.
And
I'm missing something.
There's a controversy right now. Should Scarlett Johansson be nominated for acting awards because of her performance?
No, she shouldn't.
Well, she's out selling the film. I saw her on Leno or Letterman the other night selling the film. So as you might with her. What's the clip we got here, Cynthia?
There's a question. How do you share your life with someone? And it's the conversation between Theodore and Samantha.
This is from the film Her.
So what was it like being married?
Well, that's hard for sure. But there's something that feels so good about sharing your life with somebody.
How do you share your life with somebody?
Well, we grew up together. I used to read all of her writing, all through her master's and PhD. And she read every word I ever wrote. We were a big influence on each other. I still find myself having conversations with her in my mind, rehashing old arguments and defending myself against something she said about me.
Man, I know what you mean. Last week, my feelings were hurt by something you said before that I don't know what it's like to lose something, and I found myself...
I'm sorry I said that.
It's okay. I caught myself thinking about it over and over, and then I realized that I was simply remembering it as something that was wrong with me. That was a story I was telling myself, that I was somehow inferior.
So Scarlett Johansson came back and added voice. I assume the soundtrack with Joaquin Phoenix was already there?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that...
What a challenge.
What a challenge.
For the filmmaker.
And for her, for that matter.
Yes.
Well, we never see her.
Nope.
Right. But still, she's playing off...
Yeah. And I think that clip underscores my problem with it, is that she doesn't exist. I just couldn't go there with Spike Jonze. I'm a big fan of his, but...
Yeah. Okay, that's the film, Her. Mixed feelings about that one. Let's move on to The Great Beauty, Steve. This is a portrait of an aging bon vivant.
He's a writer, 65. He's written one great novel 40 years ago that he's famous for, and he still maintains some notoriety. He lives in Rome in this apartment that has a patio that overlooks the Colosseum.
Nice.
And he and his friends sit around and drink and go to clubs and talk about jazz and... he's just kind of at a point in his life where he says, I don't care anymore about pleasing anybody. And he lets some friends go and he embraces some new ones. And it's just a beautifully shot look at Rome in all its beauty and its spiritual decline, I guess.
Cynthia, what's your sense of this film?
I loved it because I hung in there. It was a 3-hour film. It's in Italian. It is, I guess, what's the word you use, Bob?
It is a thematic sequel to Fellini's La Dolce Vita.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's the quote that should be in the newspaper. There were moments where it dragged. It just didn't make a lot of sense to me. It's won all kinds of awards in Europe. Mm. I stuck with it through the end, and I was very, very moved about this man's efforts to face mortality.
The guy that you see what in this film? What are you looking at?
Gosh, you look at some things like Fellini-esque, like there's a scene at a drive-through Botox center sort of that people come in and they call neck number 14 and they come up and they get their shots of Botox in their face, number 15. I mean, that's a scene. He's a freelance writer and he's interviewing artists. There's a lovely scene where he interviews this artist whose show consists of photographs he's taken of himself every day of his life. That started, his dad started it, and then he continued it as a grown man. And so this outdoor gallery is kind of festooned with.
There's no plot per se. This is all episodic.
Yeah.
Tony Servillo, who plays this guy, is one of the great actors in the world. We hardly know him here in America. A few years ago, he made a movie called
Il Divo
about the corrupt prime minister of Italy, and it's one of the great screen performances I've ever seen. And he's terrific in this too. He's just a fantastic performer.
It's a beautiful movie. Yeah.
Okay.
No clip because it's in Italian, but
that film again, The Great Beauty.
I think if people are interested, they really need to go see it right away. It's at the Tivoli.
Yes, Tivoli.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it may not stick around.
And it'll really look good on the big screen.
It does.
Well, I'm going to get my boxing gloves on as we move Bob Butler to the next film, Inside Llewyn Davis, the Coen Brothers ode to 1960s folk music scene back in New York City.
Wow, this is dividing audiences and critics like a hot knife through butter, I'll tell you. I happen to love this. I think this is possibly one of the Coen Brothers' greatest films. And I say that knowing that it has a leading man, Llewyn Davis, our lead character, is a jerk. He's a folk singer in Greenwich Village in 1962. He's a folky purist. He's possibly got a woman pregnant. He mooches off people. He's a leech. And here's the thing. The minute he opens his mouth to sing in the very first scene of the movie, you realize that he has a great voice and he's a fantastic performer. Basically, this is about the artist as jerk. It's also about how being a purist in your art is probably going to get you no satisfaction. There's a great scene in this where you can tell this guy's getting nowhere. People listen to him and they think he's okay. Who are they listening to? Well, there's this whiny guy, Bob Zimmerman, who comes on and he's playing guitar. That's Llewyn Davis's motto is, if it's not new and it never gets old, it's a folk song. That's his problem.
Now, his character is based on a real person.
Dave Von Ronk.
Yes.
It was the inspiration for it. As a recreation of a time and place, this is, I think, absolutely authentic. It just feels fantastically right.
Mm-hmm.
I found it to be bitterly funny at times. You guys are going to say he's not likable, and he isn't.
No, he's not. And there's moments of the film I like. I think it's the Coen Brothers' weakest film, as far as I'm personally concerned. I think John Goodman has this great scene and segment in the middle of the film.
But it's from another movie. Just doesn't fit.
What I was struck by were the faces that the Coen Brothers cast, these great faces, like his manager and his, you know, stooped over his old secretary. And that was entertaining. I was so over this guy and his whining and his lying, and I just didn't care anything about him.
You know what? I don't think he ever whines. I think he takes with a almost stoic resignation all the crap being thrown at him. I think he knows that he's never going to be a star.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's plotted out, this is my musical world, this is what I'm going to do, I'm going to sing old folk songs.
But the problem, Bob, is you don't care to think much about him after a while because he's so – you don't care. He's not likable. I'm not interested in him. I don't want to invest any of my life
in
this guy,
case
so
where
I don't care where he goes.
This is a case where the filmmaking around him, for me, was so fascinating that it carried me through.
Mm-hmm.
It was beautifully shot. There's no doubt about that. But I don't go to movies to be aggravated, and I was aggravated watching this movie.
I thought this film, I'm going to start calling the Coen Brothers the Bleak Brothers. It was sort of, what's the Academy Award winning movie they did?
No
Country for Old Men. Same kind of absolutely nothing to grasp, nothing to hang on to, and you're left with just nothing after this film. Furthermore, Robert Butler, this notion of the recreation of the 60s folk scene, it struck me as just some dark room, some bar. It could have been anywhere. Nothing authentic, nothing that transported me back anywhere. It was just some room, you know? So I don't know. Yeah.
Interestingly, it took them a lot of work to find a corner in Greenwich Village to shoot and not have it ruined by CVS signs and all kinds of things. But back to this unlikability, who's more unlikable than Meryl Streep in August Osage County? To me, her performance is interesting. Cate Blanchett's a miserable wretch in Blue Jasmine. Interesting character. Oscar Isaacs is not interesting to me.
And what were Carey Mulligan and Justin Timberlake doing
in
that
movie? They were in it for 5 minutes. I don't know. Nothing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They had nothing to do.
Bob, what's the clip we have from Llewyn Davis?
You know what? I do not know.
I do know. As a matter of fact, Llewyn is talking to his manager.
Okay.
All right.
How we doing?
We're doing great.
Really? New record's doing well?
How we doing? Not so hot, I gotta be honest. Jenny, we're Cincinnati.
What? Cincinnati, it's not in here.
It should be in there.
It's not in here, I'm telling you. Is it?
Cincinnati?
Yeah.
I got it.
What?
I got it.
You got Cincinnati?
Yeah, you want it?
Could I have it?
Should I bring it in?
Yeah.
Do you owe me something? You have to owe me something.
I wish. People need time, you know, get to know you, buy you as a solo act, even know you're a solo act. Cincinnati is not good.
That's it, right?
Yeah, this is it. God help.
Nobody knew us when we were a duo. It's not like me and Mike were ever a big act. It's not a big re-education for the public.
That's Inside Llewyn Davis, and do not go see this. And Bob owes me $10 for making me go see this from his recommendation. Okay, some local events coming up. Bob Butler, talk to me about the library and what's happening there.
Well, on Saturday afternoons at the downtown branch, we're in the midst of our 1939 Hollywood's Greatest Year. This Saturday at 1:30, we're showing Bachelor Mother, a comedy with Ginger Rogers. Hysterical. A week later, Idiot's Delight, Clark Gable, Norma Shearer. It's the only movie in which Clark Gable sang and danced. Brace yourself for that one. And then on Sunday, January 19th, the Movies That Matter series is showing Sunrise, the last great silent film made by Hollywood. It is visually unbelievable.
Hmm. Okay. How about some Oscar-nominated shorts coming up?
Yes, at local theaters, the Tivoli does this every year,
yes.
Is that they offer the nominated shorts in the live-action, animated, and documentary categories, and 9 times out of 10, you're going to wind up watching a very entertaining movie. And it's a great place for aspiring filmmakers to learn something about telling stories. And so that's coming up January the 16th.
And because people can't do everything, if I was going to steer them in one way, it'd be to the animation shorts and the doc shorts.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the feature shorts very hit or miss.
Yeah. Okay. Some other films, some things coming up down the road. Betty Page Reveals All.
You know, this is an interesting documentary about Betty Page, the great 50s pinup girl. What makes it interesting, there have been other Betty Page movies, is that the filmmakers got a hold of audio taped interviews done with her shortly before her death. And what amazes me is that she remained at the end of her days, a fairly nice person despite the terrible things that happened to her in her lifetime, including mental illness and what I could only call religious addiction and sexual abuse. I mean, all sorts of stuff. And yet what she projected in her photos was this absolutely rosy-cheeked, happy
joy. Utter joy. Right.
And joy in her own sexuality, which, you know, you can look at it and you think, this isn't dirty. This isn't erotic. This is just sort of nice.
Celebration of the female body.
That's it, yeah.
We have a clip here from Betty Page.
We do. Bunny Yeager, who is a famous photographer, worked with Betty Page. And this is Bunny talking with Betty Page. Page is on the telephone. She refused to appear in public toward the end of her life.
All right.
We were shooting some pinups on the beach one day. I asked Betty, are you afraid of wild animals? I had seen too many Tarzan movies, I think.
She set up a session for me up in Boca Raton at Little Africa to pose with the animals.
When you come into Africa USA, they had a greeter at the gate dressed all up like a native. I said, would you like to take some pictures with my model? He said, sure. He was happy about that.
I was very fond of my one-piece outfit that I made with the scallops and the high bottoms. I was dressed just like a cheetah. It wasn't much to the bottom of it, but maybe that was the most alluring part of it. And I was very proud of that design.
Cynthia?
Opens January 17th at the Tivoli.
And you recommend this thing, Bob?
Yeah, if you're at all a fan of the 50s pinup culture, this is sort of obligatory viewing.
And a lot of young people are.
Oh, she's
the upsurge in burlesque and everything. She's still influential.
Go to any tattoo shop and ask for a Betty Page design, and they'll have books of them.
Books of them. We've got 30 seconds left. What else should I be looking forward to when it comes to great films?
The Invisible Woman opens at the Fine Arts January 24th. It's the story of Charles Dickens' 13-year illicit affair with an 18-year-old aspiring actress, apparently based on a true story. Stars Ralph Fiennes, and he directs the film. film. You saw The Rocket, right, Steve?
The Rocket is a film from Australia, but it's set in Laos about a young kid and his adventures with his friends and grandmother. And
one of the best films, The Past, at the Fine Arts in Tivoli, February 15th.
Okay, we're out of time. I want to thank Bob Butler, Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker for all your great insights this week.
Thanks.
I sure appreciate it.
I'll be back for more abuse.
Yeah, okay.